So as Myla said, we're continuing on in the life of Joseph. I don't know how many more messages there'll be on Joseph, probably at least four or five. But Joseph is a good character. And his story is one of the interesting stories. So maybe we'll start off with a children's class. So if those of you who are younger than a certain age want to come forward, we'll have a little children's class. So I don't know what that age is, but okay, so we're going to be talking about Joseph and some dreams that he interpreted this morning. So I thought about this for Numbers 12, verse 6. Then he said, "Hear now my words, if there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream." So God talks to people in dreams sometimes. Ever had a strange dream? You've had a strange dream? What was your dream, Tanya? Okay. What was yours, Elise? Okay, something about dirt coming out. Grayson, what was your dream?
I lately dreamed that we went fishing.
Okay, that's a good dream. Do you think that was a prophetic dream? Did you go fishing then?
Well,
it was kind of weird. Okay, fishing at a water park. You catch very few fish at a water park. Well, so often people have dreams that they think someone is chasing them or they're following. Have any of you all had dreams like that? Yeah? I remember once when I was a boy dreaming soldiers were chasing me through a town and I could not get away from them. I kept running around corners and then they would come around the corners and they were shooting at me. That was kind of scary, but they never hit me, and then I woke up, so I never found out what would happen if they caught me, but when I did go back to sleep, that was kind of scary for me. You have to not close your eyes to have a dream. Mm-hmm, that's right. So there was a man named Elias Howe. Do any of you know who Elias Howe was?
Not me.
Not me, okay. Do any of you all adults know who Elias Howe was?
Me.
You do, Elise.
He was a flower.
He was a flower. No, he was not. He worked in the textile industry before he became a mechanic apprentice. And while he was apprenticing at a master mechanic shop, he came up with the idea of having a mechanical sewing machine. So he had a dream then about how to make this sewing machine. So he was having trouble figuring out needlework. And so normally, I guess if you have the needle go down in the wrong way, then it wouldn't make a stitch. It would just go in and it would come back out and it would just, nothing would happen. So according to family history records, he dreamed he was by a bunch of cannibals. Now that's not a very good dream, is it? That sounds like a terrible dream. How he knew they were cannibals, I don't know, but all the cannibals had spears with holes in the tips. They looked needles. And when he woke up, he realized this was the answer to his problem. He just needed to make sewing machine needles that looked just like these cannibal spears. And so that's how he solved it. That was great. That's the kind of dream we all need to have. Dreams that lead to money. That is silly. So these dreams are very different from dreams in the Bible. So Bible dreams often revealed something about the future. So we read about God saying that he would speak through dreams. Can you think of any people in the Bible who had strange dreams? Joseph had a strange dream. Yeah, he had a dream about wheat bowing down to his wheat. Yes, Grayson.
Jacob has one.
Yeah, Jacob had a stairway going up to heaven. So, in our sermon today, the baker and butler had dreams. You all remember those dreams. And Pharaoh had a dream. There was even a story about a Midianite soldier who dreamed about some running down and knocking over his tent. And that was a funny dream. But these were all special dreams that came from God and showed people something that was going to happen in the future. And I think the important thing isn't really the dream. So if you ever have a dream that tells the future, although maybe you will go fish at a water park one day. But the important thing is that God gives us dreams, and that says that God knows our future and he cares about our future. Care of us all the way through it. So you can go back to your parents now. So when I think about dreams and the interpretation of dreams, I think two people that come to my mind, Joseph and Daniel. And we remember the story of Daniel and King Nebuchadnezzar. So King Nebuchadnezzar set a hard task for the wise men in Babylon. He told them that he'd had a dream, and he wanted them to not tell them what the dream was. And I'm not totally sure if King Nebuchadnezzar really didn't remember the dream, or if he just wanted to make life pretty terrible for these wise men. But he said, "What's your interpretation of the dream if you can't tell me what the dream was?" And they said, "Well, this is crazy, King. It's not a good thing to tell the king." Anyway, the king said, "Off with their heads." And we know that Daniel and his friends somehow were not present at the conference where the king made this unreasonable demand. And Daniel asked for a little bit more time before they killed him. And God revealed the dream to Daniel after he and his friends prayed. 2:17 through 20 says, "Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, 'The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king.'" So all those, they're smart, but they don't know this. "But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days, your dream and the visions of your head upon these. As for you, O king, thoughts came into your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be." So there are two things that we see. First of all, Daniel knew the dream and its interpretation. But the second thing is that Daniel did not know the dream because of his amazing abilities, his ability to read minds or anything like that, but because God revealed it to him. And I think we see something similar in our story today. So Sigmund Freud is well known, perhaps we could say notorious, for interpreting dreams. And he that he wanted to figure out what was going inside people's heads, and so he thought the best way to figure out what was going inside people's heads was to hypnotize them. You know, if any of you have ever hypnotized somebody. Well, it turns out Freud was really bad at it. He couldn't do it. He tried really hard. I guess it's hard to do. I've never tried it. Maybe my patients would obey my instructions better if I hypnotized them. But regardless, he wasn't good at it. And so he got this bright idea. He thought, you know, to ask people about their dreams. And when they tell me their dreams, I will tell them what is going on inside their heads. But this, whatever it was, Freud was wrong about a ton of stuff, so I wouldn't rely on what he said. Regardless of that, what is going on in our passage today is not that. This is an example of God revealing the future to some people who weren't God followers. And things that is a challenge is not really the dreams, but the interpretation of the dream. So it's easy to have a dream. It is hard to figure out what the dream means. Now, I can't really figure out why I've just made up something, but It seems like the king would have figured out that they were lying. So let's turn to Genesis 40, and we're going to read this chapter, and we're going to discuss it and applications from it. So this is Joseph in prison. He is there not because he wants to be there, but because some things happened serving in Potiphar's house, and now he's in prison. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, had a dream, both of them. Each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came into them and saw that they were sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" And they said to him, "We each have had a dream, and there is no interpretation of it." It's not surprising. The dream interpreter in the prison had gotten laid off. So Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." Then the chief butler told his and said to him, "Behold, in my dream, a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded. Its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore your place, and you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. But remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. Indeed, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that they should put me into the dungeon." When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, he said to Joseph, "I also was in my dream, three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." So Joseph answered and said, "This interpretation of it, the three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." Now it came to pass on the third day, which was day, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker and interpreted to them. Yet the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. So the story begins with Pharaoh's baker and the butler or the cupbearer being cast into prison. I'm going to call him a cupbearer because that's probably a better title for him. We don't know what the crime they were accused of was. It says they offended Pharaoh. I think that I figured it out and that somebody had tried to poison Pharaoh. And since the baker was responsible for a portion of the bread that Pharaoh ate and other baked goods, the cupbearer was also responsible for security in the palace. Both were cast into prison under suspicion. Which one had done it? So both of these men were responsible for their own departments. The passage specifically calls them the chief baker and the chief butler or cupbearer. Wrong. They were to blame, even if it was somebody else's fault. It was dangerous to be a king. People were constantly trying to usurp your position And it was dangerous to serve a king because they saw shadows even when the sun was in the sky. Plenty of times people got executed for really minor stuff because the king was afraid it would lead to something that could result in their death. So Joseph, as we saw last, most important prisoner in the prison. He's responsible for seeing that affairs inside the prison run smoothly. And with these highbrow prisoners, it seems as though he took a personal responsibility for taking care of their needs. Chance encounter. These men could have been sent to any prison, but they were sent to this prison where Joseph was. And yet, at the time, and probably for a couple years afterward, it didn't seem like it was. I think it's important for us to remember that there is no such thing as a chance encounter when God is involved in your story. So I think about the story of Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. Philip was in the middle of Samaria, and he was led out into the desert to meet a single man. This man was traveling away from Judea. He was reading Isaiah 53, and he was in search of good. And Philip shared with him the gospel. And after a short discussion, the eunuch went through instruction class and got baptized. Well, something. In 1874, D.L. Moody was on one of his tours of England. He and I were sent Forest one Sunday afternoon to visit a little Romani camp that was there. While they were there, Sankey put his hand on the shoulder of one of the boys who was there and said, "May the Lord make a preacher of you." The boy's name was Rodney Smith, and he was extremely poor. He was basically illiterate, but through this encounter and several others, he became a Christian. And he began to follow Jesus. William Booth asked him to become an evangelist, and he began to call him Gypsy Smith because of his Romani background. 15 years later, he shared a carriage with Ira Sankey, and he told Mr. Sankey of the connection he shared with him and how those words had struck him. Sankey remembered, but did not remember saying those words at all. But those words made a difference in Gypsy Smith's life. And so we don't know, do we? We have chance encounters every day. We meet people that we know and some people that we don't. And we have a chance to impact them. And they have a chance to impact us too, don't they? So these two men had dreams, and they remembered their dreams quite clearly. The Egyptians believed that dreams predicted on a personal level. And they expressed distress at the fact that they had no one here to interpret the dreams for them. So this was actually a big deal in Egyptian society. And as I did a little research on this, there is a book written on papyrus dated to around the reign of Ramses II, so it's around 1200 BC, which claims to help the reader interpret the meaning of their dreams. So it's not on Hoopla. I looked, and it's not there, so you can't. Memories on the internet about it, so we'll trust them because I don't read hieroglyphics very well. So it has a formula that follows. It says, if a man sees himself in a dream doing, and then it says different scenarios, and then it's a good dream or a bad dream. So that's important, of course. You know, most of us know when we're having a good dream, and most of us know when we're having a bad dream. But these are some random things that you might be doing in your dreams. Hopefully some of these you're not doing. But so these are things that are mentioned in this papyrus, and I'll just list a few of them so you can interpret your friend's dreams. This will be handy next week. So listen carefully. So if in your dream you see yourself dead, this is a good omen. Surprising, right? You thought that would be a bad thing. No, it is a good omen because it's a sign of a long life. How many of you all have had a dream where you're dead? Wow, a couple. I've never dreamed I was dead. Well, I guess. Anyway, I'll live as long as the good Lord wants me to live. So if you are gathering dates in your dream, great news, because the gods will give you food. That makes sense, I guess. If you have a dream where you are burying an old man, it is a good omen because it symbolizes. So if in your dream you see yourself reflected in a mirror, this is a bad sign because it means you will have a new wife. I don't know why that's a bad thing, but if in your dream drinking beer, this is a bad dream because sufferings are bound to come. If in your dream you see yourself eating crocodiles, never had a dream about that. It is a good dream because in the future you will become a civil servant. Okay? If in your dream you see a snake, a pending dispute will be settled soon. And if in your dream your teeth fall out, whoever has that dream will die. I think probably people who don't have that dream will eventually die too. But anyway, interestingly, in the papyrus, it never mentioned anything about skinny cows or fat cows or birds attacking bread. So Joseph hears these men say that they had dreams, that they didn't know what they meant. He says simply that the interpretation of dreams belongs to God. And Joseph, he says in other places that he does not have the ability to understand the meaning of dreams unless God reveals it to him. So the cupbearer's dream is pretty detailed. A vine with three branches, and number three seems crucial here, the dream of the baker. The cupbearer immediately seems to have taken the grapes that were on these branches, squeezed them into a cup that he had at hand, and taken the cup to Pharaoh. And Joseph immediately gives the interpretation. The branches referred to the idea was 3 days later, Pharaoh would lift the cupbearer out of prison and restore his job to him. And here we have Joseph's plea. You know, as I was reading through the story, one of the things that is interesting to me is how silent he is through the first chapters of his life. Other than talking to his brothers about his dreams, he doesn't say anything when all these terrible things are happening. And you wonder sometimes, was Joseph some kind of a stoic person who just somehow was able to get along and it just didn't matter what happened, he was unfazed. And here we find out what Joseph was. He says, "Remember me when it is well with you, and please show kindness to me. Make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews. I have done nothing that they should put me into this dungeon." So is Joseph bothered being in prison? Absolutely. He was kidnapped. He was sold into slavery, and then he was wrongfully imprisoned. And he says, "Remember me. Everyone has forgotten me. Nobody knows about me. I have done you a little good deed here. Please remember me." Prison. The baker's dream. So the baker was encouraged that Joseph gave a positive interpretation. He's like, "Wow, this man gives good interpretations. I like this." And so he had a dream that he had three baskets of bread, eating bread out of the topmost basket. So this is not such a great dream. If he'd only had his teeth fall out in the dream, we would know for sure what the interpretation was. So Joseph told the man that the signified 3 days, and unfortunately, in those 3 days, he would be lifted up from prison. But there the similarity to the cupbearer's dream ended. The baker was to be killed 3 days. So Joseph didn't ask any favors from the baker. It's not surprising, I suppose. Baker wasn't going to be in any situation to fulfill any requests. And I think the important thing here was that interpretation for both men was accurate, and the cupbearer would have heard both of these interpretations and known that Joseph could interpret dreams. And the chapter finishes with a comment that the cupbearer did not. Do you find it interesting at all that the cupbearer's memory of his dream was so good and his memory of Joseph not so good? So he had all sorts of things. I don't remember dreams very well, actually. All sorts of little details in his dream that he remembered. But when it came to this man who had to stand out as the one who interpreted his dream, he could not remember it. And I think we can assume that the cupbearer did not really forget Joseph. But he just didn't want to shake things up in his return to favor. And so he wasn't going to make any requests on Pharaoh. He wasn't going to bring attention to Pharaoh's mind that, you know what, my cupbearer had and somehow end up back in prison. But it doesn't matter. Joseph felt forgotten. I think Joseph felt forgotten by everyone who cared about him. Maybe even God had forgotten him. And it makes clear that God had not forgotten him. So we're going to move on to just a few applications. And these are just things that I think about as I read this story. And I'll share them with you. So first of all, talent comes from God. So Joseph had some kind of a talent for interpreting dreams. And I suppose God could give that to anybody. There's a tendency for us to believe that our talents are because of us, who we are, how special we are. Muhammad Ali was a prize fighter. Some of you have heard the name. He was known for his brash confidence in the boxing ring. He told reporters, "I'm the greatest. I'm experienced now, professional. Jaw's been broke, been knocked down a couple of times. I'm bad. Been chopping trees. I've done something new for this fight. I've done wrestled with an alligator. Right, I've wrestled with an alligator, I've done tussled with a whale, I've done handcuffed lightning, thrown thunder in jail, that's bad, only last week I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick, I'm so mean, I make medicine sick." I don't even know what that means. So I have no idea if Muhammad Ali was the greatest boxer, but what I do know is that time humbled him. By the time he was in his 30s, he had in his hand, which happens to boxers. It's called Parkinson's pugilistica. It's because of taking too many blows to the head. He lost some fights as he got on in his career, and he died in his early 70s. He was no longer the greatest. And it would have been so much better if he'd been able to realize whatever talent he had came from God. Joseph had the opposite. He believed that any talent he had came from God. The blessings that he'd experienced had come from God, and it was crucial for him to acknowledge this fact to those around him. Micah 6:8 asks what God desires of us. "He has shown you, O man, what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God?" And I think our tendency is to focus on the doing justly and part and not think about the humility part. If we are walking humbly with God, it is not enough for us just to look humble. We need a humble heart. Joseph probably would have been remembered more if he'd been brash and arrogant and confident. And yet, God does not love those things. What does God hate? There's six things the Lord hates. No, seven things he detests. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that kill the innocent, a heart that plots evil, feet that race to do wrong, a false witness who pours out lies, a person who sows discord in a family. Isaiah 42, verse 8, "I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory I will give to another, nor my praise to carved images." And this is why idolatry is so bad. It is taking attention that God deserves and giving it to something else. And unfortunately, sometimes some of that attention that is due God, and we focus on ourselves. Pride is taking glory that is rightfully due to someone else, while humility is giving appropriate praise to those who are responsible. I think it's important that we don't have false humility. So if you spend hours preparing a meal, you don't have to act like you didn't spend any time on the meal. It's okay. You can say, you know, I did work hard on this, because you did. Just because you work hard on something doesn't mean it always turns out, does it? So it's a blessing when it does. Some of us are better at making things turn out than others. So give God the glory for what talents we do have. So God knows the future, and I suppose this should give us hope. God knew that Pharaoh would execute the baker before it happened. If you look at Jeremiah chapter 29, and we're not going to read that, it is a copy of a letter that the prophet Jeremiah sent to the people who had been taken away captive from Judah to Babylon. There were prophets, false prophets, who were telling the people that in only a few years, Babylon would be defeated and they would be able to return to their homes. Jeremiah 29, 4 through 7 has this section in it. Thus says the God of Israel, so to all who were carried away captive, whom I have caused to be carried away from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and dwell in them, plant gardens and eat their fruit. Take wives and beget sons and wives for your sons, and give your daughters to husbands, so that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there, not diminished, and seek the peace of the city where I have caused you to be carried away captive, and pray to the Lord, for in its peace you will have peace. And I think these verses are applicable to us. We are exiles in a country that is not our own. I hope we are all pining for heaven. Yes, many of us here, most of us who have passports have a U.S. passport, but at the end of the day, we are longing for a heavenly home. And if we look at this country, at the world around us, we see chaos. And the question is, when we see that chaos, what should it make us do? Should it make us fearful? Should it make us desire to fix Babylon, to go out there and improve the political situation? The prophet's counsel to these people was to set down roots in Babylon because they were going to be there for a while. We know that was about 70 years. But it was also to remember who they were. Jeremiah 29, verse 11 says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope." 70 years of captivity, and most of them would live their lives and would die in Babylon, far from the home they loved and yearned for. Does it help us to understand that a loving God can choose a hard path for us because it's best? So many believe that if a loving God really cared about us, he would choose an easier path. But God's goal is different from our goal. His goal is not just to get us someplace. His goal is to make us into something we are not. 2 Corinthians 3:18 says, "But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as the Spirit of the Lord." What are we being transformed into, and how are we being transformed? The first part of the verse brings up certain concepts: unveiled faces, glory of the Lord, and that is followed by transformation. Remember, when Moses would go and spend time with God, he wasn't even able to look directly at God. And yet, when he would come away from those encounters, his face would shine. And it was so bright that the people asked him to put a veil over so it would not blind them. This was not Moses' glory. This was God's glory reflected in Moses' face. And maybe we see this picture here for ourselves. We have the opportunity to see the glory of God, who he is, and then to begin to reflect that glory. Because of Jesus' work on the cross, we are able to enter even closer into relationship with God than what Moses was, even transformed bit by bit into the image of God. A young man happened upon a silversmith, refined silver and gold from raw materials, sitting in front of his fire. "Why do you heat the metal?" he asked. The refiner answered, "Precious silver. I have to remove all the impurities that make it worth less than it really is." The young man thought about his own life and how one time of fiery suffering or another was required to remove some of the junk in his life. "Why do you sit while you work?" inquired the visitor. The refiner replied, "I have to watch the fire closely. Too little heat and the impurities will not be removed. Too much heat and the precious metal will be destroyed." The young man reflected how his life of comfort had brought a sense of complacency that had led him to abandon his dreams, settling instead for a humdrum life. But he had also come through painful, fiery times, strength that he would not have found elsewhere. Then the young man asked the refiner, "How do you know when the silver is at the right temperature?" The refiner smiled and answered, "I know the purifying is complete when I can see my reflection." Zechariah 13:9, "This third I will put into the fire. I will refine them like silver. Test them like gold. They will call on my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. I will say, the Lord is our God." Some of you all have heard this story before. God is the refiner. We are the silver. And I consider sometimes the vast quantity of trash that God has to take and how little silver there is there. The only way for these impurities to come out is through suffering, through trials. And as we draw closer to God, good times can sometimes see. But it's when God can see his face clearly in our lives and when others can see it as well that he knows that the job is done and not a moment before. If we think about church history, it tells the same thing, doesn't it? When the church has been persecuted, it has been small, but the people present have been there because they desired that above everything else. And when times are good, people are in church because family is there, because they just go there for a lot of reasons. I've asked you this question before, but I will ask it again this morning. Why are you here? Are you here because you love Jesus more than anyone? Because you love the people around you, and because we are desiring to make each other more like Jesus? Or are you here because it's comfortable? All of this is sort of rambling, but I want to point out a few things. God was in control of the cupbearer and the baker. He was in control of Joseph, and he was in control of Pharaoh too. I read somewhere that many of us do not want a heavenly father. We want a heavenly grandfather, someone who has no role in disciplining us, but only a role in taking us fishing. God never abandoned Joseph, but these next 2 years that he spent in prison, feeling forgotten, feeling alone, dealing with the prison, were going to be terrible for him. And so the great heroes of faith were affected emotionally by the things that they faced. If this were a novelization of the periodic times where Joseph shared with his bumbling sidekick Bruno about how distressed he is by his circumstance, and Bruno would kind of say something silly, and then Joseph might cry out to God for relief of suffering, but we don't. But here in this passage, Joseph told the cupbearer that he was unjustly in prison and that he should never have even been in Egypt. There probably was not a day that went by that Joseph did not ask for relief of his imprisonment. But it just didn't seem to come. He spent years before he had release. Final thing is that we speak the truth even when it's hard. Ephesians 4:15 and 16, speaking the truth in love, may grow up in all things unto him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together, every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share and causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. And I think we see Joseph speaking truth to the cupbearer. He spoke truth to the baker. And I think the question really comes down to what is truth and what is a loving way to share that truth. Some people believe prophecy just means you can say mean things to other people and tell them exactly what you think about them because God has given you a prophetic voice. And I don't think that that's accurate. Paul is clear in Ephesians that speak truth should have a desire for restoration. We love the person we're sharing something with, and we want to see them come closer to Jesus. And when the reverse happens, we have to be willing to accept that too. The loving thing for Christians to do is to share the needs that we see in other people's lives. So if we see them going down a path that will lead to disaster, we need to do something about it. So thinking about it from a medical standpoint, if I do a blood test on somebody and it indicates they have cancer, is the loving thing for me to do to tell them that they have cancer or to hide it from them because it might cause? In another age, doctors lied to their patients all the time. They'd say, oh, you're making it, when they knew the patient was dying because they thought that false hope was better than no hope. I'm not sure if that's the case. I think we have a responsibility to share the truth with people. Ezekiel 3:16 through 19. Now it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore, speak the word from my mouth and give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way, to save his life, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood shall fire at your hand. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. And I think it's really important to think what needs to be shared. The information we are sharing is for people who are lost, and our goal is redemption. Unfortunately, I think too often our goal is simply to make the people around us into our own, and that's not helpful. So I don't know how hard it was for Joseph to share the truth of the baker's dream with him, but it was certainly the right thing to do. Finally, though others forget us, God does not forget. 7 says, when my father and my mother forsake me, then the Lord will take care of me. Isaiah 49, verse 15, can a woman forget her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? Surely they may forget, yet I will not forget. There are times when we feel forgotten and ignored. I don't know if the cupbearer really forgot Joseph. I think he probably remembered him at least sometimes. But God did not forget Joseph. God forgot us and promised that he will take care of us even more than a mother will take care of her newborn child. And I think it's a dangerous thing when we depend on people. John Waldron will let you down pretty well, and he wouldn't intend to let you down, but there are times that he would. But God will never let you down. He's promised that he won't forget us or forsake us, and so we need to make sure that we trust him and rely on him we do on any of the humans in our lives. So our passage began and it ended with Joseph in prison. And I was thinking about this and about the Michelangelo making one of his pietas. He's got a piece of marble when he was around 70 years old, and for the next 12 years he worked on it. He was trying to bring three figures out of it: Nicodemus, Mary, and Jesus. Chipped away at it, chipped away at it. And finally, one evening, nobody really knows why, he took his chisel at it and he started breaking off pieces of it. And his servant rescued it from him, kind of patched it up and sold it to somebody. But God works at us. Jeremiah 18, 1 through 6 talks about the potter and the clay and the ways in which the potter molds the clay, making a vessel. Comes to a flaw, he's not able to bring it to the way he wants, and he takes it and he molds it again. And Jeremiah says, this is what I want to do with you. There's so many of us who are struggling with where we're at right now and feeling like we should be farther along or at a different place. And there are so many people who are hurting, and chance encounters with them every day happen. Just because we feel ourselves in exile, because we feel ourselves forgotten, does not mean that we cannot go around us. Share compassion with them. Share the ways in which God has worked something wonderful in our lives. More than anything, we need to remember that God's timing isn't our timing. And if it takes time for the church here at Bethel to grow, for us as individuals to grow, so be it, just so we're serving God here. And the most important thing is that when people look at us, they can see our Heavenly Father's face reflected in our lives.